Last night, I did something for the first time. I went to a 40th wedding anniversary party where Alan and Sue Banyard were celebrating their 40th wedding anniversary. And their kids had phoned me up in the week before and said, "Andy, why don't you do a renewal of wedding vows in the middle of the party? We've bought Mum a ring and we could just surprise them." I said, "Guys, people normally choose whether they want to renew their wedding vows." And they said, "Oh, yeah, no, Dad will really be up for it, and we don't want to give Mum the choice." So so last night, we turned up at the Fox in Patching, and everybody, and, you know, Alan and Sue were greeting us, and it was all great, and everybody was having a lovely time. And then it all kind of went quiet, and Hannah announces over the microphone, "Mum and Dad, I wonder if you can come to the front." And yours truly walks up, and they're kind of looking a bit bewildered. And there we go. I said, "Sue and Alan, so how are, you've had 40 years. How about the next 40 years?" And you could see their kind of brain cells were kind of, we said, you know, "Do you want to renew your vows?" And right there in the middle of the celebration, it was a very poignant moment. Where after 40 years, and those of you who know Sue and Alan, Alan's had a tremendous amount of health challenges. Their 40 years of marriage had not turned out the way they hoped and aspired it would to on their wedding day 40 years ago. But 40 years later, they recommitted their life to each other. It was really, really lovely. And then I prayed and everybody burst into applause and we had some food. Fantastic. And actually, in a strange way, that's what's been happening here this morning. As we worship God, as we celebrate his goodness, as we remind ourselves of our inheritance, we commit ourselves again to the journey, to a God who has been faithful in the past, who despite our failures will continue to be faithful to us in the future, and we commit to the journey. That's what church is all about. So let me pick up the story where we've left off over these last few weeks. For those of you who are visiting this morning, we are asking a question about, do we have a vision for life? We've been talking to each other about this beautiful idea that God has saved us for a purpose. And that purpose is in some ways general to all of us who are Christians, but in other ways is utterly specific to who we are. And our life's adventure is to discover what it means to live a life intentionally in partnership with God. A partnership that Jesus Christ has made possible through his death and resurrection. And that we get to make God's world with him. A vision for life. We've had this as our kind of title slide all over the series. But just have a careful look at this. This is a beautiful picture. Kev Raddy, he's a genius. I just said to him, or we just said to him, "Kev, could you come up with a title slide for a vision for life?" And this is what Kev did. What do you see in this image? What do you see? A large door that can be opened further. Okay. What else do people see? A cross. Okay. What else do people see? Sorry, say again. Pushing back the dark to let the light. Yeah, somebody else? Light. Standing in the gap.
A man with no shadow.
Frankly, Steve, your decimal point was more illuminating. A door you have to step through into the light. Now, I've actually never had the heart-to-heart with Kev to sit down and say, what did he mean by this? So all of this is legitimate, and I don't know the right answer. But I tell you what this does for me. It does look for me, like you said, Ed, that, you know, the aircraft hangar doors where all is dark and gloomy. But actually, Jesus has gone ahead of us. Jesus, his words were, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. And for me, this image conjures up something of that, that when he rose from the dead, he threw the doors open on life beyond the shadows, life beyond death, light out of the darkness. And actually, what happens is, in when we enter into this new life, which is no longer contained, is no longer clouded in shadow, the ways we thought in the darkness don't actually do justice to life in the light. And so we come into all these kind of paradoxes of God's kingdom, that if you actually want to find your life, you've got to lose the one that was in the dark to start with. That we have to be born again. We can't kind of straddle these kind of two worlds. That it costs us everything, that we leave everything behind, and yet we are free. This kind of life in all its fullness that Jesus makes possible through his death and resurrection. And one of the great kind of paradoxes about all this is that we are free to choose, but we're not free from the consequences of our choices. And part of what it means to love is to deny. And so we have to deny a life in the darkness to embrace a life in the light. I love this quote here. Until you know what love is, you don't know what denial is. And you don't know what denial is, and until you know what denial is, you don't know what love is. Thinking about that wedding renewal of vows last night, 40 years of marriage teaches you one thing: there is no truly loving the other person unless it involves self-denial. And the same is true with Christ, that if we are to love him with all our heart and soul and mind and strength, that means walking away from our past. It means denying ourselves. It means moving on. It's in that moment when we become aware of both that you truly understand and know. Somehow, in our Christian journey, we come to this point where we have to let go of ourselves and take hold of God if we are to embrace this vision of life. I don't know about you, but this picture sums up for me so often the difference between what I sing in church and how I live my life. Anybody seen this Mr. Bean clip? You really need to go on YouTube and see Mr. Bean go diving. He's all ready to he wants to dive. He's committed to diving. He gets up there and then he has second thoughts. And it's the most hysterical piece of slapstick comic genius, actually. How many of us relate to that picture in terms of we sing a great story? Let our faith be more than anthems. Man, that really connects with me. As we want to embrace this life in all its fullness, this life in the light that Jesus has made possible, we have to walk out of the darkness. We need to deny ourselves. We so easily get distracted by so many things. We so easily compromise. I love this line. We must be willing to let go of the life we have planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us in God. We have to be prepared to let go of what is familiar that we may move on into the life that Christ has for us. And that is the story of Nehemiah. This guy in the Old Testament, in a time in Israel's history when they were in exile, when everything was going wrong. And Nehemiah prospers. He becomes the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes, the most powerful king in the world, in the most powerful empire in the world. And he is the king's right-hand man. Nehemiah is in a trusted position. He has prestige. He has power. He has wealth. He has job security. He has done very, very well. But for him to embrace a life of partnership with God, meant letting go of all that. It meant actually risking his life, putting it all on the line so that he could what? Become a builder. To go back to Jerusalem, 700 miles away, and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, which were synonymous with the glory and honor of God. And so he goes back to Jerusalem. Artaxerxes incredibly gives him permission to go. this life of partnership beginning to unfold in a new way in Nehemiah's life as he walks into the light and he leaves all the darkness of Babylon behind. But it's very, very unclear as to what he's to do next. And he goes to Jerusalem and he stays there 3 days, as we can see here in this text. And then by night, so that nobody knows, he goes on a little expedition. And he walks around and he travels around Jerusalem. I'm skipping through this bit quite quickly because we're going to come back to this in January when we talk about our vision for the church in 2015. So a lot of this we're going to pick up on at that time. But then in verse 17, he says, after he's done all of his research, he says to the people of Jerusalem, "You see the trouble we're in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me. And they replied, 'Let's start rebuilding.' So they began this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. 'What is this you're doing?' they asked. 'Are you rebelling against the king?' I answered them by saying, 'The God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it.'" And I want to just focus our attention on just one verse this morning. It's chapter 2, verse 18 of Nehemiah. "I also told them about the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me. And they replied, 'Let us start rebuilding.'" It was the apparent hand of God on Nehemiah's life that gave all these people who got used to the wall of Jerusalem being broken down, it was that kind of galvanized them into action and said, "Okay, we're going to start this. We're going to see things turned around." And I just want to make a couple of points before we finish about what we can learn from this story as we seek to open the doors and follow what Jesus has done and move out of the darkness into the light of a vision for our lives. And the first thing is this, that there is no external change that really works unless the people change internally. All the way through the Bible, there is this kind of failure to live in God's inheritance. You might have seen it in the way, many of us know people who, this may be true of ourselves, that we've got into debt and somebody bails us out. And 6 months later, guess what? We're back in debt again because the external thing changed. Someone paid off the debt. But actually, we haven't learned to manage our money right yet. You've probably all known people who have been in a really stressful job and have been complaining about that job. And then they say, "Oh, it's great. I've got a new job." Guess what happens 6 months later? They're stressed out of their brains again because it's not external circumstances that drive it. It's something internal. And change never works unless it includes us. And one of the reasons that the project with Nehemiah and the rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem worked so well is that people could see God's hand was at work and they wanted to get in on the story themselves. They said, "Come on, let's rebuild the wall." They owned this together. Unless people change internally, that does not work. And what we were talking about on Monday night at our church meeting is a number of changes, particularly around our partnership groups, where if we impose this from the top, there won't be that kind of ownership when we're saying to people, "Please, could you seek God? Could you please pray?" If our partnerships are working for us, but they're not working for the church and they're not yet working for the lost, what are we going to do about it? And to give time for people so that the Spirit of God can work from within us rather than having changed imposed from on top, so that we can go on this journey of people changing internally. This is what we were worshiping and praying about and saying this morning, "Lord, would you please change us?" The second thing is that there is no real vision without cost. Anybody recognize that lady in the top right-hand corner? What's her name? Sharapova. Phenomenal women's tennis player. I think she was the youngest winner of Wimbledon. The story of Sharapova is astonishing. When she was six, she was born in Russia. When she was six, Martina Navratilova saw her playing and said, this girl is a potential world champion, but you need to get her to America. That's where the coaches are. A six-year-old Russian girl. So her parents got together and they said, this is what we want for our daughter's life. And they weren't wealthy people, so they borrowed the money for her dad and her to go on a flight to America. They were not to see, Sharapova was not to see her mother again for another 2 years. Her dad and her arrived in America with $700. They spoke not a word of English, and they started knocking on the door of tennis academies. And nobody would, trying to get themselves understood was hard enough, but nobody would let them in until eventually they convinced one coach to watch her, age seven now, play a game of tennis. And the rest is history. A huge cost. Imagine that. Going to a country where you do not speak a word of the language with nothing more than £700. The father gave up his job. He was working nights washing dishes. He was working days stacking shelves. He did anything to make this vision a reality. Wow. And have you seen the film Pursuit of Happiness? Very powerful film about a man called Chris Gardner, who for a year with his two-year-old son — the son in real life was younger than the one in the film — spent a year homeless trying to sell healthcare products at the same time as studying to be a broker, and now lives the American dream of a multimillionaire. There's some very powerful scenes in that film. The costs that people will pay to see a vision fulfilled. Do we want to live in a world without Ebola? Do we? You imagine being a healthcare professional working with Ebola today. To see that vision fulfilled, there is a huge cost. For Nehemiah, he had to risk his life. When Nehemiah got to Jerusalem, it was a huge cost for the people there. Number one, they were farmers. You don't farm, you don't eat. So how are they going to square that one? And besides, they no longer lived in the city because it was destroyed. They lived on the outskirts. So if they came in to build the wall, they left their families vulnerable. And Sanballat, who was the governor of Samaria, he was no friend of the Jews, and he was really threatening them. It cost. But the point is that Nehemiah wasn't asking them to pay a price that he hadn't already paid himself. He'd risked his life to get there. And he led by example. And one of the things that happens in God's people is we can't expect other people to pay a price that we're not prepared to pay ourselves. Vision will always cost. It will cost us financially. It will cost us in time. It will cost us in sleepless nights and heartache. Because if it's a vision of God, it will always be beyond our resources to meet. Are we hearing me? Getting that? For the Christian, though, the cost is our worship. Jesus Christ laid down his life as a ransom for many. He made it possible for the doors to be opened and to light to break into the darkness. He is our example. Hear this. Sacrificial love is when we want to do what's wrong, but we do what is right. Sacrificial love. There comes a point in all our lives where we want to do something and God wants to do something else. In fact, this is on a regular basis. And when we choose to do what he wants and not what we want, that is worship. It's the sacrifice of cost, a sacrifice of praise, where we lay our lives down as Jesus has done for us. And just like Nehemiah, Jesus is not asking us to do anything that he hasn't already done. He has led by example. Everybody with me? The last thing is this. The vision is only realized together. There is a unique individual vision that God has for us, some of which we'll understand, not all of it we'll understand, because God works in mysterious ways and his spirit blows where he wills. Don't want to get too simplistic and black and white about this. But there is a sense in which God will always work through his people. If in Jerusalem a few of them had turned up to rebuild the wall, it would never have got rebuilt, would it? They all had to commit to it. On Thursday night, down at the Worthing Assembly Halls, I heard it again. And it's the fantasy of revival, as Lawrence Singlehurst described it the week before. That if we pray hard enough, God will suddenly, miraculously do something in our community, bypassing his church, and revival will come. It's a great dream, but it is not the way God works. God has chosen to work through his people. And revival to our community will not come before there is renewal in his church. And it will not come while the church continues to bury its head in the sand, doing exactly the same things and hoping for different results. There is a cost of change which we all have to submit to, a sacrifice of worship that we make, through which God then works to see his kingdom come and his will done on earth as in heaven. The revival fantasy where somehow God works outside of the church. Of course, God can do what he like, but he has chosen to work through the body of Christ. Which takes us to Perth, Australia. Did anybody, I know I played this clip on Monday night, but have a look at this on YouTube. Some poor unsuspecting commuter in Perth, Australia, is on his way to work, and he goes to step on the train, and he falls between the gap between the train carriage and the platform, and he gets stuck around his thigh. Now, the average train carriage weighs 46 tons. And if you see on the video, you don't get the whole picture. What happened was they could see that they just needed to tilt the train a bit. So a few people tried. Well, you can't move 46 tons. Then the guard comes along and a few more people join in, and he tries to coordinate their efforts. But that doesn't work. So then what the guard does is he gets in the carriage and he says to everybody in the train, "Can you move to the other side?" So that they're creating a bit of weight. And then loads more people come, and then on the kind of famous 1, 2, 3 push, enough time to kind of yank the guy out. Now, it's a really disappointing anticlimax. I want this video to finish with this guy going, "Thank you," and, you know, shaking people's hands, kneeling down, confessing his sins, you know, all that sort of thing. He doesn't. He just walks off embarrassed. But the image is a beautiful image about the story of Nehemiah, and it's a beautiful image about the people of God in any generation. This renewal is too big for any one of our lives. But when God moves in us together, and when none of us expect that we're going to pay less price than somebody else, we're all committed to this. When we understand the cost of the vision and that change doesn't happen without the internal changes in us, that's when God's kingdom begins to come. Lessons to learn from Nehemiah. No external change really works unless the people change internally. There's no real vision without cost. The cost we pay is our worship, and the vision is only realized together. Let's stand and pray, and we're going to have some coffee.